Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Ghost, Chiller, and Lovecraft Stories. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Get ready for two great Orson Welles episodes of The Black Museum, what he terms as London's Mausoleum of Death. And now, our show.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse full of souvenirs, where everyday objects, a skipping rope, a glass, an iron, a stepladder, all are touched by murder. Now you take this key.
This was on the floor beside the body, sir.
A door key. The kind that fits only one lock. But whose?
Perhaps the murderer's, sir.
Today, this key can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Now, The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Well, here we are in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Here lies death, arranged neatly on the shelves and tables open to your view. Now, here's a spoon. It's a simple household spoon. Our murderer was meticulous. With this, he measured out a careful dose of poison. That oar up there on the wall, that was used by the stroke of a famous rowing aid at Henley. Later, it was used in anger, swung at a man who stood on the edge of a pier, stunning him. The man drowned in the Thames very quickly. Ah, here we are. Here's the key. An ordinary key. The kind used to open most of the front doors in London. Once this key was in the pocket of a man who was waiting for another in his room at the Kingsley Arms Hotel in Surrey.
Regan?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me, sir. I'll just turn the bed down.
Certainly. I'm waiting for Mr. Regan. You don't happen to know what time he'll be back, do you?
No, sir, but if you wait here, you're sure to catch him.
Thanks, I will. I particularly want to see him.
The conversation lapsed. The visitor sat down again. The maid completed her work and left, stealing a glance at the young man as she closed the door behind her. Night fell. Lights came on in the guest bedrooms. But in one room, the number on the door was 22, a man sat alone in the darkness, waiting. The night passed, and morning came. In the hotel, there were beds to be made, rooms to tidy. No answer from room 22. The maid was pleased her work could be accomplished without interruption. She was thinking of this as she opened the door. Stepped in. The bed was unused, turned down just as she'd left it. Sunlight was flooding through the two windows. And on the floor, a man lay dead. The manager called the police. The police requested the assistance of Scotland Yard. And Inspector Sidney Russell and Detective Sergeant Hobbs were sent down to Surrey.
This is the room, sir. Number 22.
Has anyone been in there since the maid found the body?
No one, Inspector, except myself and the local police sergeant. On his orders, I kept the room locked.
Good man.
There you are.
Thank you. I'll let you know when we need you, sir.
The two detectives covered the room, and in their quick survey of the murder scene, they found several leads.
His wallet, sir.
Let's have a look at the identity card, Sergeant.
There you are, sir.
Name's Thomas Regan. What else have you got there, Sergeant?
Roll a note, sir.
The killer either missed that or the motive wasn't robbery.
Oh, I don't think it was robbery, sir. His watch is still on his wrist.
Going?
No, sir. It stopped at 7:25.
That might have been the time the murder took place, though on the other hand, the watch might have run down this morning.
He was shot through the head, sir. Surely somebody must have heard that.
You would think so.
Well, here's a shell I found on the carpet.
Point 22. We'll keep this for ballistics. What else, Sergeant?
Oh, some silver taken from his trouser pocket, a handkerchief with the initials T.R. in the corner and a cigarette lighter.
With the initials T.R. He's well labeled.
And this was on the floor beside the body, sir.
A door key, the kind that fits only one lock. But whose?
Perhaps the murderer, sir?
Unless it belonged to Regan himself.
Oh, it's not the kind they use in hotels.
No. Was he wearing or carrying a keychain?
No, sir.
Then the key would have been carried in his pocket along with his money.
Which hadn't been spilled onto the floor.
You may be right, Sergeant, but to make absolutely sure, that key should be checked against every lock in Regan's home and his office and everywhere he might have occasion to visit. If it does not belong in any of those places, then it seems to me that when we find the door that key fits, we find the murderer.
The detectives went downstairs to talk once more to the hotel manager.
Inspector, this is a terrible business. Listen to those men in the bar.
What about them?
They're newspaper reporters. Oh, this is really dreadful. The notoriety, the reporters, the headlines. It'll ruin my business.
It wasn't very nice for Mr. Regan, either.
No, I suppose not, poor devil.
What can you tell us about him?
Only that he was a commercial traveler.
He's stayed here before? Oh,
several times.
A traveler, eh? Did he work for any firm in particular, would you happen to know?
Yes, I do know, because they always paid the hotel bills. He worked for a London firm, Hardy and Sons Limited.
Thank you, sir. I'll leave the room upstairs locked until we have it photographed and checked for fingerprints.
Oh, Inspector, there's one other thing I'd better mention. I think it's important.
Yes?
A man called to see Mr. Regan last night.
Did you get a good look at him?
I didn't see him at all, nor did the desk clerk. The maid found him waiting in room 22 when she came in to turn the bed down.
Unusual, isn't it? Knowing Regan's room number? It suggests an acquaintance.
Not necessarily, Inspector.
Why do you say that?
We have a register here in the foyer. It's on that wall over there.
A room register?
Yes, just a card opposite the room number. Some people don't bother with it, but Mr. Regan always put his card up.
So that maid is the only one who saw this man?
Yes, Inspector.
Then I'd like to talk to her, sir.
Oh, I'll go and get her for you.
The hotel manager returned almost immediately with the maid. She was a young girl, very pale, her eyes still fearful from the sight she'd seen on the floor of room 22.
Annie Mitchell, Inspector.
How do you do, Annie?
This is Inspector Russell from Scotland Yard.
How do you do, sir?
Annie, what time did you turn down the bed in room 22 last night?
It was going on for 6, sir.
And I believe Mr. Regan was not in his room.
No, sir, but there was a man there.
Could you describe him to me?
Well, he was tall, fairly young-looking, and dark hair. He spoke educated-like.
I see. What did he say?
Just that he was waiting for Mr. Regan, and he particularly wanted to see him.
Tell me, would you know this man if you saw him again? Well,
yes, I think I would.
The inspector was well satisfied, but Sergeant Hobbs, who had been questioning the guests, had not fared so well.
Now, sir, I'm sorry to trouble you, but I have to ask you a few questions.
Really, this is most annoying. I've been kept here all the morning, and it's extremely inconvenient.
I quite understand, sir. Now, can you tell me whether you heard any unusual noise or disturbance during the night?
The only disturbance of which I'm aware is the disturbance created by the police this morning.
You didn't hear a shot, for instance?
Certainly not.
And you were in your room the whole evening?
Yes. Can I go now?
Yes, that'll be all. Thank you very much.
Well, it's certainly not been a pleasure.
It seems nobody heard a shot last night, sir.
Nobody at all?
Not a single guest, even those occupying adjoining rooms.
That's funny. Anyway, I'm leaving you in charge here. The police surgeon will be arriving to carry out a post-mortem.
All right, sir. Are you going back to London?
Yes, I think the case winds up there. The next move is to London to check that key against every lock in Mr. Regan's home and his office just to see if it fits.
I'm very sorry to bother you, ma'am, but I'd like to go right over the house, if you don't mind, trying the locks, and if there are any cases or cupboards, etc., that I might miss, I'd be very pleased if you'd point them out to me. I've come along to see if you can help me, sir, in connection with Mr. Regan. I want to know if there's any desk or a cupboard in his office, or the office door itself, which has a lock for which this might be the key. I believe you've a lock-up garage here, formerly rented by Mr. Regan. It must, of course, have a lock, and I'd be glad if you'd allow me to compare the lock with this. No, sir. I've checked every conceivable place connected with Regan, and the answer's the same everywhere. The key does not belong.
In that case, we have our answer. Somewhere, someplace, Sergeant, there is a door, and behind that door, we'll find the murderer. You know, if I was a philosopher, I would say that it's rather symbolic that we have a key to which we must fit the lock. Still, I'm not a philosopher, I'm a detective, and it's our job, Sergeant, to find the lock, to find the door, and to find the murderer. And that's just what we're going to do, Sergeant. We're going to find the door that this key fits.
In time, they were to find the door. By patient, methodical methods, they came to the front door of a small flat. The key fitted. The same key that can be seen today in the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. And now we continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Inspector Russell went back to London, certain that the crime had motive and that the motive would only be found by a search into the habits and associations of Thomas Regan. His first call was to the offices of Hardy & Sons, Limited, where he was speedily ushered into the presence of the reigning Mr. Hardy.
Come in, Inspector. Sit down.
Thank you, sir.
Shocking business. Now, who could have wanted to kill poor Regan?
That's what we're trying to find out.
Of course. Shocking. one of our best travellers.
What do you know of his personal life, Mr. Hardy?
I may be able to help you there, Inspector. I believe in taking an interest in my employees. I've always encouraged them to bring their troubles to me.
And Regan had troubles?
Yes. He was a bachelor. Rather a gay one at times. I suspect he was having trouble over a woman.
Yes?
A married woman. She kept on ringing up to speak to him, and the thing spread in the office. He was rather embarrassed and slightly worried about it all.
Do you happen to know the woman's name, Mr. Hardy?
I'm afraid I can't help you there, Inspector, though... Wait a minute.
Yes?
He did mention something. That's right. I've got it now. He didn't want to tell me her name.
That's a pity.
But in admitting she was married, he did tell me that her husband was a doctor on hospital duty.
A doctor?
Yes, and one other thing I recollect. He mentioned her first name. It was Lindell.
And I have information that the man we want to interview is young. That suggests a hospital intern.
Yes, with a wife named Lindell. Not very much to go on, Inspector.
It might be quite a help. He never told you, I suppose, whether it was a London hospital or not?
He never said so, but I'm quite sure it would be. At least the wife lives in London.
What makes you think that?
Well, the number of telephone calls that woman made to Regan. Nobody could afford that many trunk line calls.
So they began in London, St. Bartholomew's Hospital.
An intern or a young doctor whose wife's name is Lindell.
The registrars of the big hospitals consulted their records, made special inquiries. St. Thomas's, Westminster, Guy's. Each one of them returned to shake his head. There are several hundred hospitals in the London area. Big general hospitals, small private nursing homes, special hospitals, children's hospitals, maternity, infectious, orthopedic hospitals. At the first 42, they drew a blank. Then, at the London Royal Hospital at last.
A young intern whose wife's name's Lindell. That's a funny one, Inspector.
It's all the information we have, Doctor. It's useless to ask, I suppose, whether you might have this man on your staff.
But we do have him.
What?
Well, at any rate, one of our interns has a wife named Lindell, Dr. Bowen. Dr. Felix Bowen. I'll send for him, shall I?
No, wait, Doctor. Could you give me some idea what this Dr. Bowen looks like?
Yes, I think so. He's young, 31, I think. Quite tall, dark hair.
Would you have his address here in your records, Doctor?
Certainly. I'll get it for you, Inspector.
Thank you.
And shall I send for Dr. Bowen?
No, I don't want to see him just now, and I don't want it known that any inquiries have been made about it.
Very well, you can depend on me. Is he in some kind of trouble?
Nothing to worry about just yet, sir. Now, if you'll get me that address...
Patience had paid off, the 43rd Hospital. Now, to interview Lindell Bowen. Inspector Russell went to the address he'd been given, a small flat in a good residential district. The lock on the door fascinated him. The urge to try out the key in his pocket was almost overwhelming. But instead, he knocked.
Mrs. Byrne?
Yes?
I'm Inspector Russell from Scotland Yard.
Scotland Yard?
May I come in?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
She was young, an attractive woman, but her eyes were frightened.
Mrs. Byrne, when did you last see Thomas Regan?
Regan? Thomas Regan?
I think you know who I mean.
But I don't, Inspector. I'm very sorry.
Not at all, ma'am. Perhaps I'm mistaken.
Well, of course, I've read about him in the papers. That is, if it's the same Mr. Regan.
It is the same. Mrs. Byrne, with your permission, I'd like to conduct a small experiment.
Experiment? I don't understand, Inspector.
It's quite simple. This key.
Key?
I'd like to try it in your front door.
But I...
Of course, if you choose to say no, then I won't be able to try it.
You won't?
But well, I also ought to warn you that I can return in a very short time with a warrant.
All right. Try it.
Thank you, Mrs. Byrne. I'll just open the door and insert the key...
The key turned, effortlessly and easily. Hope died in the woman's eyes. The inspector from the yard took out the key and closed the door again.
And now, Mrs. Byrne, you and I are going to have a talk about Thomas Regan.
afternoon, several significant events took place. A gun was found beneath a pile of medical books. It was taken to Scotland Yard to the ballistics expert there.
The gun checks, sir. That's the murder weapon, right enough.
Little wonder nobody heard the shot in the hotel. It's fitted with a silencer.
A silencer. Evidence of premeditation. Late that afternoon, the record of its purchase was uncovered. The second significant event.
The gun was bought at a shop in the Soho district, sir. A second-hand shop, 2 weeks ago.
By whom, Sergeant?
The description covers Dr. Felix Bowen. And the proprietor says he could recognize the man if he saw him again.
We'll give him that chance. Come on.
Where to, sir?
The hospital, to pick up Bowen.
The third event was Bowen's flight across London. Somehow, in some way, the doctor learned of the net that was closing about him and made a run for it. He was gone when the detectives reached the London Royal Hospital. They drove to his home, but he wasn't there. Now across England, the vast network of police communications went into action. The teletype carried the news of the fugitive.
Central to all stations. General alarm for one Dr. Felix Bowen, age about 31, 6 feet tall, dark hair. Educated voice, quietly spoken. Wanted on suspicion of murder.
The search was on. In 1,000 stations, vigilant eyes searched for Bowen. On the streets, on trains and buses, in restaurants and hotels. Within 24 hours, he was picked up.
I really must insist. This is a terrible mistake. I really don't know what this is about.
And I'm sure you've got nothing to worry about, sir. Just answer a few questions, that's all.
Well, of course, I'm perfectly prepared to cooperate with the law. But I must insist on an explanation at once.
Yes, yes, of course, sir. You see, unfortunately, your appearance coincides with the description of a man wanted by the police.
Oh?
It's just a routine matter, sir. If you'll give me some proof of your identity, we can clear the matter up in a few minutes.
But I explained to the constable it's no longer compulsory to carry an identity card.
Yes, I know that, sir. But before we release you, we must have proof of your identity.
Yes, but how can I...
You see, sir, we must be sure you're not the wanted man.
But I've told you already...
Now, Mr. Bowen.
Yes?
Yes. Dr. Bowen.
Inspector Russell.
This is Sergeant Thompson, sir. Hargett. We've picked up a man who we believe is Dr. Felix Bowen.
Hold him, Thompson. I'll be there in a matter of minutes.
It was Bowen, right enough. But if Inspector Russell hoped for an easy confession, he was disappointed. The doctor was defiant and tight-lipped.
I know nothing, I tell you. Nothing whatever. This whole thing is an outrage.
I must remind you, sir, that your wife has made certain admissions.
My wife? What has she told you?
That she and Regan were having a love affair. That you found out. And the day before last, you went down to Surrey to see Regan. You returned late that night.
Did I?
And under a pile of medical books in your bookcase, we found the gun you used. The game's up, Bowen.
The game is never up, Inspector. Until it's lost.
The evidence they had accumulated was impressive. But juries are cautious, and defense counsels are often very smart. There had to be no loopholes. There had to be complete corroborating evidence.
I think we've got our man all right. The next thing is to prove it beyond all shadow of doubt.
What's the next move then, sir?
Well, Sergeant, there's one person who got more than a passing glimpse of the murderer.
Oh, you mean Annie, the maid at the hotel.
Right. We'll see how Mr. Bowen fares on an identification parade. I have a feeling he won't fare too well. Now, Annie, I expect you've heard of an identification parade.
Yes, sir, like they have on the films.
That's right, Annie, but this is not a film. This is the real thing. Before we go into the next room, I want to impress on you how important it is that you make no mistake. A man's life may depend on your judgment. So when you answer me, make sure, absolutely sure, beyond any shadow of doubt, the man you identify is the man you saw on the night of the murder.
Yes, sir.
Right, then. Now, in the next room, there are 8 men. I want you to follow me into the room, take a good look at each of them, and see if you can pick out from amongst them the man you saw in room 22 waiting for Mr. Regan.
Very well, sir. It's not the first gentleman. Nor the second. But this is the man, sir.
That's a lie.
Yes, and that's his voice. I'd know it anywhere. This is the man, Inspector.
Well, Mr. Byrne, would you like to make a statement to us now?
I have nothing to say, except that I doubt that the evidence of a silly maid is likely to give you a conviction, Inspector, whatever you may think.
We're depending on more than that, Mr. Byrne. There are other witnesses, including a silent witness, a door key. That was careless of you, Mr. Byrne. Very careless indeed.
Bourne was identified also by the owner of the second-hand shop as being the man who had bought the gun some 2 weeks before. With that, the case was complete. A door key had helped to find a murderer, and that self-same key can be seen today in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment. Now here, in person, is Orson Welles.
Bourne killed the man who had stolen the affections of his wife. His was not a clever crime. It was premeditated, without a doubt, but clumsily conceived. For the young doctor was no student of the art of murder. Yet he might have escaped justice, had not a key fallen from his pocket. A key which ultimately brought the police to his front door. And now, until we meet next time in the same place, and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, is presented by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Radio Attraction. The program is written by Creswick Jenkinson, with music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.
Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. A museum of death. Yes, here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a fountain pen, a cufflink, a high-heeled shoe, all are touched by murder. Here's a scarf, torn and ragged, a faded tartan, a cheap reproduction of the honorable colors of the Stuarts, red with green blue crossings and a double over check of white and yellow. This scarf belonged to Walter Hoffman Pievsky, known to the police and his friends in the underworld as the Pike.
There's no doubt about this scarf being his property, Superintendent. He was wearing it when he was sent to Dartmoor 10 years ago.
Ah, the description tallies, does it?
Exactly. It's all written down in the prison property book, even to the patch on it.
So the Pike's our man. Right. Well, get him.
And get him they did. And all because of a scarf, appropriately known in Cockney circles as a choker. The Pike applied his choker to a human throat. The throat of the driver of a post office van. The Pike pulled the choker too hard. It was instrumental in convicting him of murder. And that's why it's earned its place here in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Well, here we are in the Black Museum. Beyond these gray walls, the mighty roar of London never stops. But in here, it's quiet. Come with me under the frieze of death masks, the masks of criminals of bygone days, suspended grimly under the ceiling. Come. To our right and left, rows of murder exhibits, each one carefully labeled. That cut glass scent spray is attractive even now. Might even take its place on Madame's dressing table, till we stop and read the label written under it. Yes, it's been used to spray anesthetic over the faces of helpless women as a prelude to murder. No sickly aroma now as we squeeze the bulb. Except for its grim associations, the fragile exhibit is insignificant, easily broken. But it was strong enough to hang the man who used it. There, there's a brass candlestick. Over there, a taper to go with it. Now, here we are. Here's what we're looking for. The faded tartan scarf. As I take it out of the showcase, I ask you to come with me back to the time when this scarf was new, 15 years ago. Walter Pievsky bought it from a stallholder in one of London's famous street markets, Petticoat Lane.
Yes,
I'll take one of the scarves, mister.
Right, sir. Finest worsted we're wearing. What's your clan? Campbell's, Cameron's, MacDonald or MacLeod? All genuine tartan today down from the islands.
All right, all right. I've bought it already. Don't need to give me that stuff. I'll take this one.
It's the Stuart. And better than that you cannot do. Not half a nicker. Not five bob. Half a crown and cheap at the price. Thank you very much. Come and get your Scotch chokers from Honest John Mackay. If your next warm...
While Honest John continued his honest trade, the Pike went about his own particular business. It was less exhausting than John's, and it was worked from a public call box. In professional circles, they called it the hospital trick.
Hello?
Is that Mrs. Peterson speaking?
Yes, who's that?
The London Hospital here, Mrs. Peterson.
Hospital? Why, what's happened?
Well, there's no need for immediate alarm, but I'm sorry to say that your husband has met with a serious accident.
Oh, Bill? Is he hurt? Oh, no, what's happened?
He was knocked down by a bus in the Whitechapel Road about half an hour ago.
A mean, crude trick. But more often than not, it worked. While the stricken woman hurried to the hospital to find the husband, who, of course, was not hurt at all, the Pike would visit her house. With the coast clear, he'd help himself to whatever he could lay his hands on and get out before the bewildered woman returned. And you notice that the Pike could almost camouflage that accent he had. This gift gave him a confidence which was almost his undoing. One time, when he and some friends were removing the entire contents of a house while the owners were away on holiday.
What about the piano, Pike? Do we take that?
Of course we take everything. Who'd think of moving house and leaving the piano behind, eh?
You'll get as blooming well as you will. Okay, boys, piano next. Oh, crikey, the phone. Here, what do we do about that? Let it ring, I suppose.
No. Maybe it's someone seen the van outside and checking up. I'd better answer it.
Yeah, yeah, go easy,
Pike. Don't worry, Ed. I know my job, don't I?
Oh, yeah.
Hello?
Is that Mr. Wilson?
No, I'm awfully sorry. He won't be back until about 7 o'clock. I'm his brother-in-law. Can
oh,
I help you?
If your sister's there.
Oh, Julie's just gone out for half an hour. Can I take a message?
Yes, I think you can. I'm her brother. Who the blazes are you?
Quick, boys. Let's get out of here.
Right out.
So the piano was left behind after all. But Pike got away with most of the household belongings, and observe, not only were his operations becoming bolder, but he had planned his action carefully. He even knew that Mrs. Wilson's first name was Julie, but he didn't know she had a brother. That must have shaken him, because from then on he changed his tactics. The Pike entered the motor racket, a racket which was to take him in turn from Dartmoor prison to the scaffold. But in his early days as a motor thief, there was still a trace of strange humor about his work. The padlocked car was a case in point.
Who's that?
Okay, Eddie, it's only me. You wouldn't go reaching for a gun when Parky walks in on you.
I'm sorry, Pike, it's me nerves.
Well, relax. Now listen to me, I've got a job for you.
Nah, I'm laying off for a bit.
Okay, then who pays the rent?
Oh, I'm only going in for the small stuff.
Well, this is a small job I'm offering you.
What is it, busting into the Bank of England, eh?
No. It's a simple matter of knocking off a nice new motor.
Well, what's the dope?
Well, it's this way. The car belongs to a fellow named Lambert who lives at 14 Graysdyke Crescent. See? He can't get it into the garage beside the house on account of it being too big.
Why didn't the mug measure it before he bought it?
Well, that's not our concern. He locks the car up at night, and I've obtained a duplicate set of keys.
Oh, nice work, nice yeah. work. Yeah, what do you want me in on the job for? You can do it yourself.
Oh, there is a little complication.
Oh, I thought there would be.
This fellow Lambert is like a mother with a child over this car. He fixes it to a lamppost every night with two big padlocks and a double chain. Wonder he doesn't put a nappy on it, too.
Well, what do we do? Take the lamppost as well as the car?
And before I tell you, are you in with me?
All right, Pike, I'm in.
Then listen to what I tell you.
In the early hours of the following morning, the Pike and his assistant went along to Graysdyke Crescent, and there, sure enough, chained to the lamppost outside number 14, was a fine new motor car, its cellulose and chromium work glinting invitingly under the lamplight.
It's a special, Eddie, eh?
What did I tell you?
We can clean up 450 on this, and all we've got to do is to remove the back wheel, which is chained to the lamppost. We put on the spare and we're away.
Okay, Pike.
Let's get cracking.
The offending wheel was removed from the axle and left, still chained, to the lamppost. And by the light of the helpful rays from above, the spare wheel was bolted on, the tools were replaced in the boot, and the two men climbed into the car.
I hope that ignition key of yours works, Parker.
Of course it works. I tried it out last night.
Ah, good for you.
And here we go. I told you it was going to be easy, didn't I, Ed?
It's money for old Roper. Ah, you're a good one, you are, Pikey. Just let me know when you need any more help. I'm your man.
Walter Pievsky pulled his tartan scarf snugly around his throat and agreed that he would certainly keep his assistant in mind. The car itself was taken to a garage, where its numbers and appearance were carefully changed and, in due course, found its way by devious routes back to the open market. The Pike, of course, had to split the profits which hurt him, so on his next job, he decided to work alone. And it was the next job which put him on the long, long walk which was to finish on the scaffold.
Now, what's the number of that gouge? Ah, here it is, I've got it. This works, Puck, my lad. You're in the money. But it all depends on how good I can sound on the phone. I'll copy my father's voice, twist his soul. Here we go.
Motors. Good evening.
Hello? Breen's?
Yes, sir. Can I help you?
My name is Maurice Blouet of 17 Granford Court.
Oh, yes, sir. I know. The big block of flats in Colliton Drive.
That's right. I am staying here with a friend, Major General Lewis.
Oh, yes, sir.
He tells me that you have a new Rolls Coupe in your showroom.
Yes, sir. Indeed we have.
Yes, well, I'm anxious to take such a car back to the continent with me, but time is pressing.
Are you at 17 Granford Court now, sir?
Yes, if someone could bring round the car, I should like to see it.
Right, I'll be with you in a quarter of an hour, sir.
Are you sure that is not too much trouble?
Oh, no trouble at all, sir. Thank you very much for ringing.
Thank you. I shall be waiting for you.
15 minutes later, the car drove up to the block of flats. The driver salesman got out and went inside. Entering the lift, he went up to the third floor and knocked on the door of number 17. Needless to say, the occupier had never heard of either Maurice Blouet or Major General Lewis. But while the questions and explanations sorted themselves out, Walter Pievsky was already driving the luxury car toward the garage where practiced hands were waiting to completely change its identity. First, what the Pike did not know was that he had provided the police with a vital clue that was to lead him first to prison and then, by reason of the tartan scarf, to the gallows. But the scarf was yet to earn its place, of course, among these strange exhibits here in the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with the Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Now we continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
We return to Walter Pievsky, known as the Pike, elated at the success of his confidence car trick. He made a handsome profit on the rolls And despite the fact that the police subsequently traced it, they never traced the theft back to the Pike. Not until he tried the same operation again. Certainly he changed the district, but, as is so often the case with a regular criminal, he develops regular habits, and the routine served up to the local garage was almost exactly as before.
Yes, I'm staying with Sir Leslie, and he tells me you've got that straight 8 in the showroom. I'm most anxious to take a car back to the continent with me, but time is pressing, and
you see... I'd be delighted to bring the car around to you right away, sir, if that's convenient.
If you're sure that it's not too much trouble.
No trouble at all, sir. I'll be with you in 10 minutes.
Oh, that is most kind. Thank you. Excellent.
But you wouldn't think it was so excellent from your point of view if you knew what was happening at the garage, Pike.
Hello? Give me the police. Is that Scotland Yard?
Yes, information room.
Listen, my name is Slater. I run a garage, Carlsbrook Street, North 1.
Yes, sir?
A few weeks ago, the local police warned me about a car thief who worked a telephone trick, asking salesmen to take cars round to fake addresses for inspection.
He rung you, has he, Mr. Slater?
Yeah. It might be him, or it might be genuine. But he asked me to take a car round to 21, Goldstone Court, Cattimore Street.
On the advice of Scotland Yard, Mr. Slater took the car to Goldstone Court. To make it easier for the thief, he left the doors unlocked and went into the building. When he was safely inside, the Pike left his telephone box and walked smartly over to the waiting motor. There were just two things he didn't know. First, an ignition wire had been snipped. And second, he was being watched. She'll never start until that broken wire is mended, Pike. You're wasting your time. You're going to waste a lot more time, too. 7 years, to be exact.
Hello, sir. You having a bit of starting trouble?
Oh, hello, officer. Yes, I don't know what's happened here.
I'm used to this sort of thing, so is the other constable here.
Oh, there's two of you.
There's a lot more at the end of the road. Suppose you hop out of that and let us see whether we can't get the car going for you.
No, I can manage.
All the same, you might let us have a go for you.
Okay.
That's the idea. Are you the owner of this car? Hold him, George. He's got a knuckle there, sir.
Let me go, you swamp!
No, you don't.
Oh, God. Put the bracelets on him, quick. You all right, 71?
Oh. Well, how is he?
Looks as if his jaw's broken, Inspector.
Right, take this man to the station. What's his name?
I ain't talking.
Very well. I'm charging you with grievous bodily harm and resisting arrest for the attempted theft of this vehicle. There may be further charges.
There were further charges, including the theft of the big rolls. Walter Pievsky, alias the Pike, had played the same game once too often, and a search of his flat in the East End produced more evidence of his varied career in crime. The police had been waiting for him to make his first mistake. This time he'd done it. At the Old Bailey, he pleaded guilty to over 100 crimes, and there were hundreds more with which he was never charged. He was sent to prison for 7 years, and immediately on his reception, his personal belongings were entered in the property book, and he was wearing the tartan scarf which later was to hang him.
Silviette, grey, 7½, collar, 16, brown, one scarf, red background, green and blue stripes, white and yellow overcheck.
A canned steward.
How do you know that, Pievsky?
The fellow I bought it from in Petticoat Lane told me.
I'll take his word for it. Oh, there's a small tear, 5 inches in one corner. Been roughly patched. Better put that down.
Don't worry, boys. I won't accuse you of doing it.
Don't you worry. I'll be retired by then. One pair of leather gloves, size 8, one pair of black socks, 10, brown shoes, neat.
The tartan scarf had been duly entered, and little did the retiring prison officer dream that his hastily scribbled details were to be subsequently brought up as key evidence in a murder trial. But Pievsky signed the list of his personal property, and for the next 7 years he was a guest of His Majesty's government in the most famous prison in England, Dartmoor. But in 1946, justice had run its course. The Pike was given back his personal property, which included the tartan scarf, of course, all duly signed for, and so he was released upon a battle-scarred London. Time passed, and he added to his lawful wages by meager pickings from the black market, and more time passed, until one day the inspiration came to him like a bolt from the blue. He mulled it over in his mind. He carried out the research. And not until the plans were cut and dry did he put Ed Javison in the picture.
This is it. This is going to be the cleanup, Eddie.
Yeah, what is it, Pike?
We're going to stick up a post office van, see?
A post office van?
Shh. I've been standing in for a chap selling papers right outside a big post office in the West End. Every night I watch the mailbags coming out and going into the vans around 6 o'clock. Huh? Well, the other night I hired a car and followed one. It cut through Braston Mews to Park Lane.
Did you say you hired a car?
Yes, what about it?
Never mind. Go on.
Well, I had it out 3 nights and I found the vans don't change their route. It's the Mews every time. Cuts off a bit of traffic, you see?
Yeah. Go on.
Now, the Mews are very dark. Badly bombed and no residents that I could see.
Yeah, I'll get it, yeah.
All we have to do is get a fast car and wait there until the last van comes through.
Yeah, how many are there?
Only two. We draw our car out in the path of the second one as if we were going to back into the garage, see?
Yeah.
The van stops.
Yeah.
We fix the 2 men in it, fill up our car from the back, and bring the stuff back here to sort.
To sort? Oh, I like that. Yes. Here we can bring it through the back way. When do we do it?
Well, I think our most profitable haul will be tonight, Friday.
But what about a car?
Oh, you can leave that to me.
And Walter Pievsky ran true to form. He wanted a fast car in a hurry. He applied the methods he knew. He worked the telephone trick on a young and trusting motor salesman who duly delivered a shining, high-powered limousine to a block of flats. As he disappeared into the entrance full of expectation, the Pike drove off rapidly to Braston Mews, where his partner was waiting for him. The timing was perfect. As the car stopped, the first post office van was already approaching.
Here, keep your head down, Ed. Here it comes. The second one won't be more than a minute or so behind. We must turn the car broadside onto it.
How did you get this bad?
I'll tell you later. It's hand-picked, see? Plenty of room in the back for the luggage. There we are. Nothing can get by now.
What happens if something tries to get through before the van arrives?
Well, we make way for it and come back another night if necessary. Here, what's this?
It's the van. We're going to be all right.
And nobody about. Couldn't be better. Now, get out.
Yeah?
Keep your chin tucked into your scarf like me.
Oh, no.
Pretend to be pushing the car.
Right.
What's up? Come down.
Afraid so.
Could you give us a push?
Sorry, mustn't leave the van.
Oh. Well, look, in that case, I wonder if you'd like to earn yourselves 10 bob, eh? If you could ring this number for us when you get to your own destination, it's my garage.
I'd log in and send a breakdown for you, eh?
That's the idea.
Oh, don't mind doing that for you. I'll do it for nothing.
Oh, thanks, Sam. You're very kind. If you've got a pencil, I'll jot down my name. It's rather a difficult one.
Yeah, here's a pencil.
Oh, help! Dirty thieves! Oh! That's got the both of them.
Good. We'll start getting the bags out quick.
No, you don't.
I'll set you up, you snivelling idiot.
I'm choking. This skull's choking me.
Here, quick with the bags, Ed.
Oh, no, here they come. I'm going. You're swinging for the...
Start getting the stuff in the car.
Okay.
All right. That's about as much as we can take. What's happened to the driver?
Oh, don't worry about him. Get moving.
Here, look at his tongue. His eyes. You've killed him.
Stop talking. Get on with the job.
There's a car coming. They've got us in their headlights. It's the cops.
Well, let's get out of here. Hold tight on the corner.
Keep going. They're after us. Oh, watch the traffic lights. They're red. Something's coming.
We got through.
Oh, I thought we'd had it. Oh, the police car's held up by the other car.
But get away, Ed. I'm going to make it.
Put them in! Slow up! We can't get round!
Ed Javison died in that crash, so mutilated that his body could not be identified. By some miracle, the Pike escaped and staggered away into the shadows. But his tartan scarf was still round the throat of his victim, lying in the Mews. Now let Superintendent Brandreth take up the story of the hunt.
Well, the hunt was soon over. In fact, as soon as the car was reported stolen, I had a call from one of my inspectors.
I thought you'd like to see this.
What is it, Harrison? Oh, stolen car. Well?
Well, I've checked with criminal records, sir. There was something familiar about the method. You know, calling up a garage and getting the salesman to deliver the car to a block of flats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the list of men who practiced that.
Now, these two are inside at present.
Yes.
This one's going straight. Well, he's out of London anyway.
That leaves this one, Walter Pievsky.
Yes, sir. The Pike.
Nowhere to find him?
He's sharing a place with a man named Javison in the East End.
Right. Bring him in.
Yes, sir.
But before the Pike was picked up for questioning about the car, his scarf was...
was immediately recognized as the one which we believe Pievsky had stolen. In theory, the evidence against him was already piling up. If he was the car thief, he was probably the murderer as well. But I needed that extra piece of evidence. I called for everything that was known about him, including the list of his personal property which he had signed in prison. It was a shot in the dark, but it yielded results.
There's no doubt about the scarf being his property, Superintendent, even to the patch on it.
Within 24 hours, the Pike was caught. Still dazed by the car crash, he offered no resistance. In due course, he was convicted of the murder of William Price, the driver of the post office van. And at 8 o'clock, one cold morning in February, he was hanged. All because of this tartan scarf, which has earned its place today in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment. Person is Orson Welles.
Under English law, there are no degrees of murder, and the death sentence has to be pronounced on a man or woman convicted of the crime. Recommendations to mercy by the jury are always carefully considered. But in the case of Walter H. Pievsky, no such recommendation was made. The evidence against him was unshakable, and on the eve of his execution, he reproached himself bitterly. Not for the death of his victim, or even his unfortunate partner, but for two other reasons. The supreme crime of murder had brought him no profit, and as his last hour approached, he became increasingly angry at his own forgetfulness. Ah, yes, they usually overlook something. And that's why the faded piece of tartan has earned its place here among the other exhibits in the Black Museum. Now, until we meet again in the same place for another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, is presented by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Radio Attractions, with original music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch, produced by Harry Allen Towers.
We hope you enjoyed these two episodes of The Black Museum with Orson Welles. If you did, please send us a review and share with friends. And you Spotify listeners, we appreciate comments as well. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn. This is 1001 Ghost, Chiller, and Lovecraft Stories. Until next time, everyone, stay safe, and we'll be back soon.